This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, narrated by Suzanne Torin, and directed by T.G. Reynolds and Tiana Kennedy.
Chapter 11. I Am Now Public Property. As the confusion and turmoil of secession swept Washington, the Lincolns made final preparations for their departure from Springfield. In early January 1861, Mary journeyed to New York, both to spend time with her son Robert, whom she had been wild to see since he had left for the East Coast a year earlier, and to shop for a wardrobe befitting a first lady. Staying at the Astor Hotel, she was feted by merchants eager to sell her fancy bonnets, richly textured shawls, kid gloves, and bolts of the finest antique silk for fashionable dresses. The store owners happily extended her credit, encouraging an extravagant spree, the first of many. After years of making do on a limited budget, this woman, who was raised in a wealthy household, took great pleasure in acquiring everything she wanted, even to the point of outspending her wealthier sisters. Buying was an intoxication with her, her biographer Ruth Randall writes. It became an utterly irrational thing, an obsession. Mary's desire for elegant clothes reflected more than vanity, however. She was undoubtedly aware of the whispering comments about her plain looks and her husband's lack of breeding. Could he with any honor fill the presidential chair? One guest at an elegant restaurant was overheard saying. Would his Western gaucherie disgrace the nation? Her fighting spirit stimulated, she was determined to show the world that the civility of the West was more than equal to that of the East. Entranced by her experience in New York, Mary stayed 3 extra days without notifying her husband, who plunged vainly through sleet and snow 3 nights running to meet her train. When she did return, Mary was in the best of spirits, as was her handsome, well-dressed son, whose outward appearance was said to present a striking contrast to the loose, careless, awkward rigging of his presidential father. The Lincolns decided to rent out their house on 8th Street, selling some of the furnishings and putting the rest into storage. Before packing their belongings, however, they held a farewell levee in the twin parlors of their home. Mary was in her element as she graciously welcomed a crowd of 700 Springfield friends. It was, Villard commented, the most brilliant affair of the kind witnessed here in many years. Mary was thrilled by the attention, and relished the lavish gifts presented by office seekers. Nonetheless, she became increasingly apprehensive about her husband. Shortly before she left for New York, she received an unwelcome present from South Carolina, a painting depicting Lincoln with a rope around his neck, his feet chained, and his body adorned with tar and feathers. For Mary, terrified of thunderstorms and fearing death with every illness, the gruesome painting undoubtedly left her cold with foreboding. For Lincoln, the hours of his remaining Springfield days must have seemed too short. The never-ending procession of office seekers and the hard work of packing left little time or space for the most important task of all, the composition of his inaugural address. Unable to concentrate either in his home or in the governor's office, he sought places to isolate himself and be undisturbed. For several precious hours each morning, he wrote and honed the words that were awaited anxiously by both the conciliators and the non-compromisers alike. As the time for departure drew near, Lincoln appeared unusually grave and reflective, saddened by the prospect of parting with this scene of joys and sorrows during the last 30 years and the large circle of old and faithful friends. He journeyed to Farmington for an emotional farewell to his beloved stepmother, Sarah, and to visit his father's grave. Returning home, he called on Billy Herndon, his law partner for 16 years. He wanted to assure Herndon that his election would only interrupt their partnership in the firm. "If I live, I'm coming back sometime, and then we'll go right on practicing law as if nothing had ever happened." The day of February 11th was damp and biting as Lincoln, accompanied by family and friends, headed for the Western Railroad Depot. The circuitous 12-day trip to Washington, D.C. would permit contact with tens of thousands of citizens. He had packed his own trunk, tied it with a rope, and inscribed it simply, "A. Lincoln, White House, Washington, D.C." His oldest son, Robert, would accompany his father on the entire trip, while Mary and the two younger boys would join them the following day. Arriving at the train station, Lincoln discovered that more than 1,000 people had gathered to bid him farewell. He stood in the waiting room, shaking hands with each of his friends. His face was pale and quivered with emotions so deep as to render him almost unable to utter a single word, a reporter for the New York Herald noted. Just before 8 a.m., Lincoln was escorted to the platform of his private car. He took off his hat, requested silence, and began to speak. "My friends, no one not in my situation can appreciate my feeling of sadness at this parting. To this place and the kindness of these people, I owe everything. Here I have lived a quarter of a century, and have passed from a young to an old man. Here my children have been born, and one is buried. I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington. I hope, in your prayers, you will commend me. I bid you an affectionate farewell." Many eyes, including Lincoln's, were filled with tears as he delivered his short but moving remarks. As he turned to enter the cars, 3 cheers were given, the Herald reporter observed, and a few seconds afterwards the train moved slowly out of the sight of the silent gathering. Lincoln would never return to Springfield. Neither the luxurious presidential car, decorated with dark furniture, crimson curtains, and a rich tapestry carpet, nor the colorful flags and streamers swaying from its paneled exterior, could lift the solemn mood of the president-elect. For most of the ride to the first major stop in Indianapolis, Villard noted, Lincoln sat alone and depressed in his private car, forsaken by his usual hilarious good spirits. Lincoln understood that his country faced a perilous situation, perhaps the most perilous in its history. That same morning, Jefferson Davis was beginning a journey of his own. He had bade farewell to his wife, children, and slaves, heading for the Confederacy's new capital at Montgomery, Alabama. To the cheers of thousands and the rousing strains of the Marseillaise, he would be inaugurated president of the new Confederacy. Alexander Stephens, Lincoln's old colleague from Congress, would be sworn in as his vice president. Lincoln's spirits began to revive somewhat as he witnessed the friendly crowds lined up all along the way, buoyed by the cheers, the cannon, and the general intensity of welcome. When he reached Indianapolis, 34 guns sounded before he alighted to face a wildly enthusiastic crowd of more than 20,000 people. They lined the streets, waving flags and banners as he made his way to the Bates House, where he was scheduled to spend the night. Knowing that here in Indianapolis he was expected to deliver his first public speech since election, he had carefully crafted its language before leaving Springfield. From the balcony of the Bates House, he delivered a direct, powerful talk, one of the few substantive speeches he would make during the long journey. He began by illustrating the word coercion. If an army marched into South Carolina without the prior consent of its people, that would admittedly constitute coercion. But would it be coercion, he asked, if the government, for instance, but simply insists upon holding its own forts, or retaking those forts which belong to it? If such acts were considered coercion, he continued, then the union, as a family relation, would not be anything like a regular marriage at all, but only as a sort of free love arrangement. His words provoked loud cheers, sustained applause, and hearty laughter. The speech was considered a great success. As the train rolled into Cincinnati the next day, John Hay noted that Lincoln had shaken off the despondency which was noticed during the first day's journey, and now, as his friends say, looks and talks like himself. Good humor, wit, and geniality are so prominently associated with him in the minds of those who know him familiarly, that to see him in a melancholy frame of mind is much as seeing Reeve or Liston in high tragedy would have been. Reeve and Liston were celebrated comic actors in Shakespeare's plays. It is interesting to note that Hay considered Lincoln's despondency an aberration rather than the rule. The following day, as Lincoln was feted in the state capitol at Columbus, Ohio, he received a telegram that the electors had met in Washington to count the votes and make his election official. For weeks, Seward and Stanton had worried that secessionists would choose this day to besiege the capitol and prevent the electors from meeting. The day, Lincoln learned, had passed peacefully. "The votes have been counted," Seward's son Fred reported to his wife Anna, "and the capitol is not attacked. General Scott had his troops all under arms, out of sight but ready, with guns loaded, horses harnessed, and matches lighted, so that they could take the field at a moment's notice. But there was no enemy." Seward himself was immensely relieved to have passed the 13th safely, believing, he wrote home, that each day brings the people apparently nearer to the tone and temper, and even to the policy I have indicated. I am at last out of direct responsibility. I have brought the ship off the sands, and am ready to resign the helm into the hands of the captain whom the people have chosen. Despite his stated intentions, Seward would make one later effort to resume the helm. In Columbus, a great celebration followed news of the official counting of the votes. In the late afternoon, Lincoln was presented at a full evening dress reception at Governor Dennison's home for members of the legislature. Following dinner, he attended a lavish military ball, where it was said that he danced with Chase's lovely daughter, Kate, much to the irritation of Mary. The image of Lincoln dancing with the 20-year-old beauty, tall, slim, and captivating, was spoken of in hushed tones for many years afterward. In fact, the charismatic young belle could not have danced with Lincoln that evening, for she was absent from the city when the Lincolns arrived. In an interview with a reporter more than three decades later, Kate maintained that "Mrs. Lincoln was piqued that I did not remain at Columbus to see her, and I have always felt that this was the chief reason why she did not like me at Washington." For the rest of the trip, as the train wended its way through Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, Lincoln said little to elaborate his position. Never comfortable with extemporaneous speech, he was forced to speak at dozens of stops along the way. He was determined not to foreshadow his inaugural address, or to disturb the tenuous calm that seemed to have descended upon the country. He chose, therefore, to say little or nothing, projecting an optimistic tone that belied the seriousness of the situation. Lincoln repeatedly ignored conflicting statements in both his own house-divided speech and Seward's irrepressible conflict speech, assuring his audiences that "there is really no crisis except an artificial one. I repeat it, then, there is no crisis, excepting such a one as may be gotten up at any time by designing politicians. My advice, then, under such circumstances, is to keep cool. if the great American people will only keep their temper on both sides of the line, the troubles will come to an end. Throughout his journey, Lincoln endeavored to avoid any suggestion that might inflame or be used to destabilize the country before he could assume power. He simply acknowledged the cheers of the crowd, relying upon his good humor to divert attention from serious political discussion. In Ashtabula, Ohio, he playfully answered calls for Mrs. Lincoln by suggesting that he should hardly hope to induce her to appear, as he had always found it very difficult to make her do what she did not want to. In Westfield, New York, he kissed Grace Bedell, the little girl who had encouraged him to grow a beard. For Mary and the boys, the trip was a continuous carnival, with rounds of cheers, salvos of artillery, flags, banners, handkerchiefs, enthusiastic gatherings, in short, all the accessories of a grand popular ovation. Every glimpse of Mary or the children through the windows drew wild applause, as did the image of her smoothing her husband's ruffled hair and giving him a kiss before they disembarked in New York City. To those who listened attentively for any revelation of the incoming administration's intentions, the speeches were a great disappointment. In his diary, Charles Francis Adams lamented that Lincoln's remarks on his journey toward Washington are rapidly reducing the estimate put upon him. I am much afraid that in this lottery we may have drawn a blank. They betray a person unconscious of his own position, as well as of the nature of the contest around him. Good-natured, kindly, honest, but frivolous and uncertain. In fact, Lincoln was not oblivious to the abyss that could easily open beneath his feet. While he observed the utmost caution of utterance and reticence of declaration, John Nicolay noted, the shades of meaning in his carefully chosen sentences were enough to show how alive he was to the trials and dangers confronting his administration. In Trenton, for example, while he asserted that the man does not live who is more devoted to peace than I am, he recognized that it might be necessary to put the foot down firmly. At this point, Hay noted, he lifted his foot lightly and pressed it with a quick but not violent gesture upon the floor. The audience erupted with such sustained applause that for several minutes Lincoln was unable to continue his remarks. Lincoln again revealed his strength of will in his short address at the Astor Hotel in New York City, while he opened with a conciliatory tone, promising that he would never of his own volition consent to the destruction of this Union. He qualified his promise with, unless it were to be that thing for which the Union itself was made. 2 days later, speaking in Independence Hall in Philadelphia, he clarified what he meant by those portentous words. Moved by a keen awareness that he was speaking in the hall where the Declaration of Independence was adopted, he asserted that he had never had a feeling, politically, that did not spring from the sentiments embodied in the Declaration. It was not the mere matter of the separation of the colonies from the motherland, but something in that Declaration that provided hope to the world for all future time. It was that which gave promise that in due time the weights should be lifted from the shoulders of all men, and that all should have an equal chance. If the Union could be saved upon that basis, he would be among the happiest men in the world. But if it cannot be saved without giving up that principle, he maintained, he would rather be assassinated on this spot than to surrender it. Lincoln's ominous mention of assassination may have been prompted by the previous day's report of a plot to kill him during his scheduled stop in Baltimore, a city rampant with Southern sympathizers. Lincoln first received word of the plot through the detective Alan Pinkerton, responsible for guarding him on the trip, who advised him to leave Philadelphia at once and pass through Baltimore on a night train ahead of schedule to confound the conspirators. This, according to Ward Lemon, who accompanied Lincoln on the trip, he flatly refused to do. He had engagements with the people, he said, to raise a flag over Independence Hall in the morning, and to exhibit himself at Harrisburg in the afternoon. That same afternoon, Seward's son Fred was in the Senate gallery when a page summoned him to speak with his father at once. Meeting in the lobby, Seward handed Fred a note from General Winfield Scott, carrying a similar warning of trouble in Baltimore. "I want you to go by the first train," Seward directed his son. "Find Mr. Lincoln, wherever he is. Let no one else know your errand." Fred immediately boarded a train and arrived at the Continental Hotel in Philadelphia, where Lincoln was staying, after 10 that night. "I found Chestnut Street crowded with people, gay with lights and echoing with music and hurrahs," Fred recalled. Lincoln was encircled by people, and Fred was forced to wait several hours to deliver his message. "After a few words of friendly greeting, with inquiries about my father and matters in Washington," Fred remembered, "he sat down by the table under the gaslight to peruse the letter I had brought." After a few moments, Lincoln spoke. "If different persons, not knowing of each other's work, have been pursuing separate clues that led to the same result, why then it shows there may be something in it. But if this is only the same story, filtered through two channels, and reaching me in two ways, then that don't make it any stronger. Don't you see?" Then, Fred related, noticing that I looked disappointed at his reluctance to regard the warning, he said kindly, "You need not think I will not consider it well. I shall think it over carefully and try to decide it right, and I will let you know in the morning." The next morning, Lincoln agreed to leave Philadelphia for Washington on the night train as soon as his engagement in Harrisburg was completed. Pinkerton insisted, against Mary's judgment, that she and the boys should remain behind and travel to Washington in the afternoon as scheduled. Wearing a felt hat in place of his familiar stovepipe, Lincoln secretly boarded a special car on the night train, accompanied by Ward Lemon and Detective Pinkerton. All other trains were to be sidetracked until Lincoln's had passed. All the telegraph wires were to be cut between Harrisburg and Washington until it was clear that Lincoln had arrived in the capital. At 3:30 a.m., the train passed through Baltimore without mishap and proceeded straight to Washington. At 6 o'clock, a relieved Lemon recalled, the dome of the Capitol came in sight. It was an inauspicious beginning for the new president. Though he arrived safely, critics, including Edwin Stanton, spoke maliciously of the manner in which Lincoln had crept into Washington. A scurrilous rumor spread that he had entered the train in a Scotch plaid cap, Scottish kilts, and a long military coat. "It's to be hoped that the conspiracy can be proved beyond cavil," wrote George Templeton Strong in his diary. "If it cannot be made manifest and indisputable, this surreptitious nocturnal dodging or sneaking of the president-elect into his capital city, under cloud of night, will be used to damage his moral position and throw ridicule on his administration." Lincoln regretted ever heeding General Scott and Detective Pinkerton. The question of Lincoln's accommodations in Washington for the 10 days until his inauguration had been debated for weeks. In early December, Montgomery Blair had issued the Lincolns an invitation to stay at the Blair House on Pennsylvania Avenue, offering the very room General Jackson intended to occupy after leaving the White House, and insisting that the Blairs would be delighted for you to begin where he left. In the meantime, Senator Trumbull and Congressman Washburn had rented a private house for the Lincolns several blocks from the White House. When Lincoln had passed through Albany on his roundabout tour, however, Weed strongly objected. He advised Lincoln that he was now public property, and ought to be where he can be reached by the people until he is inaugurated." Lincoln agreed. "The truth is, I suppose, I am now public property, and a public inn is the place where people can have access to me." A suite of rooms was reserved at the celebrated Willard Hotel, which stood at the corner of 14th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, within sight of the White House. Seward and Illinois Congressman Washburn were appointed to greet Lincoln and escort him to the Willard. Accounts vary, however, as to whether Seward was actually there to meet the train. He wrote his wife that "the president-elect arrived incog at 6 this morning. I met him at the depot." Nevertheless, Washburn later claimed that Seward had overslept and arrived at the Willard 2 minutes after Lincoln, much out of breath and somewhat chagrined to think he had not been up in season to be at the depot on the arrival of the train. What is certain is that Seward greeted the president-elect with a virtuoso performance, attempting to control his every movement and make himself indispensable to the relative newcomer. The two men breakfasted together that morning in the Willard, choosing from an elaborate menu of fried oysters, steak and onions, blancmange, and pâté de foie gras. Then, after breakfast, Seward escorted Lincoln to the White House to meet with President Buchanan and his cabinet. Lincoln's surprise call disconcerted Harriet Lane, Buchanan's niece, who had brilliantly performed the role of hostess for her bachelor uncle. The appearance of Buchanan's successor signaled the end of her days in the White House. Afterward, she had few kind words to say about the new couple who would occupy her former home. She likened Lincoln to the tall, awkward Irishman who waits on the door, but insisted that the doorman was the best-looking. About Mary, Harriet claimed, she had heard only that she is awfully Western, loud and unrefined. From the White House, Seward shepherded Lincoln to see General Scott. An inch taller than Lincoln, and twice his weight, the old hero of the Mexican War was now scarcely able to walk. After the conversation with Scott, Seward and Lincoln drove together for an hour through the streets of Washington. Pressing issues, particularly the still unfinished cabinet, required immediate attention. Months earlier, Lincoln had promised Weed and Seward that if John Gilmer of North Carolina would accept a seat, he would offer him a position. Seward considered the inclusion of a Unionist Southerner vital in retaining the border states, and Lincoln also considered Gilmer the best choice due to his living position in the South. Gilmer had failed to respond to Lincoln's invitation to visit him in Springfield, however, and Seward had been unable to secure a positive reply. Simon Cameron remained a candidate whom Seward considered a necessary ingredient in the cabinet. 5 weeks earlier, Seward had warned Lincoln that to grieve as well as disrespect Cameron would produce great embarrassment. "I should dread exceedingly the army of Cameron's friends in hostility." In fact, after much painful deliberation, Lincoln had decided to offer Cameron a place. During his train trip through Pennsylvania, he had met with a delegation of Cameron supporters who assured him they were authorized to speak for Governor Curtin and Alexander McClure. All the charges against Cameron had been withdrawn, they told Lincoln. The state now stood strongly behind him. Apparently, the fear that Pennsylvania might have no representation in the administration had brought warring factions to agree on Cameron. Telling the delegation that the information relieved him greatly, Lincoln remained unwilling to make his decision until he reached Washington. The problem was that Cameron still insisted on the Treasury position, which Lincoln had resolved to give to Chase. Only when Cameron realized he was not in a position to dictate what he wanted, did he grudgingly accept the War Department. When his carriage ride with Seward ended, Lincoln rested for an hour in his suite before receiving his old adversary, Stephen Douglas, at 2:30. Then, while Seward went to the train station to greet Mary, he welcomed the Blairs, Francis Sr., and Montgomery. "The Blairs," Hay wrote in his diary, "have, to an unusual degree, the spirit of a clan. Their family is a close corporation. They have a way of going with a rush for anything they undertake." Lincoln understood all this, but he liked and trusted the old man, and knew that he needed former Democrats and hardliners to counterbalance Seward. The Blairs had been appalled by Seward's conciliatory speech. Old man Blair warned Lincoln that Seward's compromises resembled Mr. Buchanan's approach and would only invite more aggression from the South. Indeed, the Blairs so violently championed their hardline position that they effectively advocated war. Monty contended that so long as the Southerners continued to believe that one Southern man is equal to half a dozen Yankees, they would never submit to anything without a decisive defeat on the field. "It will show the Southern people that they wholly mistake the quality of the men they are taught by demagogues to despise." Only as magnanimous victors could Northerners afford to conciliate. Beyond Seward's premature willingness to compromise, Francis Blair Sr. cautioned that the New Yorker would prove a perpetual thorn in Lincoln's side. "In your cabinet, his restless vanity and ambition would do nothing but mischief. He would set himself up as a rival and make an influence to supplant all aspirants for the succession." While Lincoln generally respected the opinions of old man Blair, he had long since determined that he needed Seward for the premier post in his administration. He also hoped, however, to include Monty Blair in his cabinet. While the availability of a true Southerner would have left no room for the border state Blair, the attempt to enlist Gilmer had apparently failed. Lincoln was prepared to offer Monty a position, most likely as U.S. Postmaster General. As Lincoln was conversing with the Blairs, Seward made his way through the large crowd at the train depot. Unaware that Lincoln had arrived earlier that day, the throng had gathered to welcome him on the special 4 o'clock train. When the train finally arrived, one reporter noted, four carriages were driven up to the rear car, from which Mr. Seward soon emerged with Mrs. Lincoln and her sons. Once it became clear that the president-elect was not aboard, the assembled citizens began to voice their dismay. The rain was pouring down in torrents, there was no escape, and the crowd indulged in one or two jokes, a little whistling, and considerable swearing. This was not the welcome Mary had expected. Leaning upon Seward's arm as she alighted at the Willard, she was anxious. She had distrusted Seward from the start, fearing that he would be a continuing rival to her husband. Now she was forced to depend on him during her less than triumphant entry into the city that would be her new home. That evening, Lincoln visited Seward's home for a dinner hosted by Fred's wife, Anna, who served as mistress of the household while Frances remained in Auburn to complete some ongoing work on her home. Although Frances would visit several times a year, she never made Washington her home, leaving all the social duties to her husband, son, and daughter-in-law. Lincoln returned to the Willard for a 9 o'clock reception with the members of the Peace Convention, called by Virginia to attempt a compromise before Congress adjourned on March 4th. As the convention members from both South and North assembled, one of the delegates, Lucius Chittenden, representing Vermont, called upon Lincoln in his suite to brief him on the workings of the convention. Chittenden knew that many of the Southern delegates had come simply to scoff or to nourish their contempt for the rail splitter. He could not imagine how Lincoln, who had traveled for 10 days and just escaped a conspiracy against his life, could face a gathering in which so many were openly hostile. Yet Lincoln's wonderful vivacity surprised every spectator, Chittenden marveled. He spoke apparently without premeditation, with a singular ease of manner and facility of expression. representing Ohio, was Salmon Chase, whom Lincoln had not seen since their meeting in Springfield. Still uncertain whether he would have a place in the cabinet, Chase stiffly assumed the responsibility of introducing Lincoln to the members of the delegation. Lincoln, Chittenden recalled, had some apt observation for each person ready the moment he heard his name. The introductions complete, a lively discussion ensued. In the end, the peace convention produced no proposal that could command a majority in Congress, indicating that the time for compromise had passed. That evening at the Willard, however, the delegates had gotten a revelatory glimpse of the president-elect. "He has been both misjudged and misunderstood by the Southern people," William Reeves of Virginia said. "They have looked upon him as an ignorant, self-willed man, incapable of independent judgment, full of prejudices, willing to be used as a tool by more able men. This is all wrong. He will be the head of his administration, and he will do his own thinking." Judge Thomas Ruffin of North Carolina considered Lincoln's unwillingness to make concessions on the territorial issue a great misfortune, but was relieved to hear of his hearty support of the Constitution. The next morning, a clear and blustering day, with a wind that sweeps over this city with mighty power, Seward escorted Lincoln to St. John's Episcopal Church. Then, returning to Seward's house, they conferred for 2 hours. "Governor Seward, there is one part of my work that I shall have to leave largely to you," Lincoln said. "I shall have to depend upon you for taking care of these matters of foreign affairs, of which I know so little, and with which I reckon you are familiar." At some point that morning, Lincoln handed Seward a draft of his inaugural address and asked for his suggestions. The following day, Seward and Lincoln made an informal visit to the House and the Senate. Senators from all parties congregated to greet Lincoln. Even firebrand Southerners, who refused to acknowledge his presence, were consumed with curiosity. Virginia's James Mason, one reporter noted, affected nonchalance and pretended to be writing, but for the life of him he could not help looking askance from time to time, and it may be doubted if what he wrote could be translated into plain English. One reporter commented that Lincoln's face has not yet become familiar enough to be popularly recognized here, so he passed to and from the Capitol yesterday without catching the attention of the multitude. His informal visit, the New York Times noted, was without a precedent. His illustrious predecessors deemed it incompatible with the stately dignity of the executive of the Union to visit the coordinate departments of the government. Clearly, the rail splitter has, in following the dictates of his own feelings, rightly interpreted the proprieties of his position. In the days ahead, Lincoln confirmed 2 more positions for his cabinet. He chose Caleb Smith, his old Whig colleague, over Schuyler Colfax for the Department of the Interior, despite widespread support for Colfax. In a gracious letter to Colfax, he explained, "I had partly made up my mind in favor of Mr. Smith, not conclusively, of course, before your name was mentioned in that connection. When you were brought forward, I said, 'Colfax is a young man, is already in position, is running a brilliant career, and is sure of a bright future in any event. With Smith, it is now or never.' I considered either abundantly competent and decided on the ground I have stated." Mentioning that Colfax had not supported him during his Senate campaign against Douglas, Lincoln begged him to not do me the injustice to suppose for a moment that I remembered anything against you in malice. At one point, Norman Judd had been in consideration for a cabinet appointment, but the opposition to him in Illinois from Lincoln's campaign manager, David Davis, and a host of others, was very strong. Mary Lincoln herself had written to Davis as an ally in the cause against Judd, charging that Judd would cause trouble and dissatisfaction, and if Wall Street testifies correctly, his business transactions have not always borne inspection. Mary, unlike her husband, was unable to forgive Judd's role in Trumbull's victory over Lincoln in 1855. In the end, Lincoln decided he alone would provide sufficient representation for his state of Illinois. Instead, he offered Judd a ministry post in Berlin, which was more agreeable to Judd's wife, Adeline. For weeks, the newspapers had been reporting that Gideon Wells was the most likely candidate from New England. Though bitterly opposed by Seward and Weed, Wells had the full confidence of the more hardline members of the party. Nonetheless, Wells was in an agony of suspense during that last week in February, as he waited in Hartford for positive word. When his son Edgar eagerly wrote from Yale that he would love to accompany his father to Washington for the inauguration, Wells replied, "It is by no means certain, my son, that I shall go myself. If not invited by Lincoln, I shall not go at all." Finally, on March 1st, Wells received a telegram from Vice President-elect Hannibal Hamlin in Washington. "I desire to see you here forthwith." In his hurry to catch the train the next day, he discovered he had left his toiletries behind. More disconcerting, he arrived at the Willard to find the corridors so crowded that his trunks were temporarily mislaid, forcing him to remain in his rumpled clothes. Fortunately, Lincoln was dining elsewhere that evening, and a meeting was called for the following day. Lincoln offered him the Navy portfolio. With hardliners Blair and Wells on board to balance Cameron and Bates, Lincoln still faced a difficult problem. He had resolved from the start to bring both Seward and Chase into his cabinet, but as the inauguration approached, each man's supporters violently opposed the appointment of the other. "The struggle for cabinet portfolios waxes warmer hourly," the Evening Star reported on March 1st. Seward's delegation met with Lincoln on March 2nd, claiming that Chase would make the cabinet untenable for Seward. Hoping Lincoln would agree to forsake Chase, they were dismayed when, instead, Lincoln countered that although he still preferred a cabinet with both men, he might consider offering State to William Dayton and giving Seward the ministry to Great Britain. After receiving the report of his friends, and beleaguered by the strength of the opposition to him, Seward sent a note to Lincoln asking to withdraw his earlier acceptance of the State portfolio. Lincoln waited 2 days to answer. "I can't afford to let Seward take the first trick," he told Nicolay. Nonetheless, his gracious manner again soothed a troubled situation. In his reply to Seward's withdrawal note, he wrote, "It is the subject of most painful solicitude with me, and I feel constrained to beg that you will countermand the withdrawal. The public interest, I think, demands that you should, and my personal feelings are deeply enlisted in the same direction." Never genuinely desiring to withdraw, but hoping to pressure Lincoln to drop Chase, Seward rescinded his decision and accepted. In a letter to Francis, the New Yorker portrayed his waffling reversals in the most honorable light. "The president has determined that he will have a compound cabinet, and that it shall be peaceful and even permanent. I was at one time on the point of refusing. Nay, I did refuse for a time to hazard myself in the experiment. But a distracted country appeared before me, and I withdrew from that position. I believe I can endure as much as anyone, and may be that I can endure enough to make the experiment successful. At all events, I did not dare to go home, or to England, and leave the country to chance." All that remained was for Lincoln to secure Chase's acceptance. He had not exchanged a single word with Chase about the appointment since his arrival in Washington. Now, without consulting the proud Ohioan, Lincoln sent Chase's nomination as Treasury Secretary to the Senate. Chase was on the Senate floor when a number of his colleagues came over to congratulate him. Ever conscious of his own importance and overly sensitive to matters of protocol, he promptly called on the president to express his anger and his decision to decline the appointment. In the course of their ensuing conversation, Chase later recalled, Lincoln referred to the embarrassment my declination would occasion him. Chase promised to consider the matter further, and, as Lincoln hoped, he finally yielded. In the end, Lincoln had unerringly read the character of Chase and slyly called Seward's bluff. Through all the countervailing pressures, he had achieved the cabinet he wanted from the outset, a mixture of former Whigs and Democrats, a combination of conciliators and hardliners. He would be the head of his own administration, the master of the most unusual cabinet in the history of the country. His opponents had been certain that Lincoln would fail in this first test of leadership. The construction of a cabinet, one editorial advised, like the courting of a shrewd girl, belongs to a branch of the fine arts with which the new executive is not acquainted. There are certain little tricks which go far beyond the arts familiar to the stump and the crossroad tavern, whose comprehension requires a delicacy of thought and subtlety of perception secured only by experience. In fact, as John Nicolay later wrote, Lincoln's first decision was one of great courage and self-reliance. Each of his rivals was sure to feel that the wrong man had been nominated. A less confident man might have surrounded himself with personal supporters who would never question his authority. James Buchanan, for example, had deliberately chosen men who thought as he did. Buchanan believed, Allen Nevins writes, that a president who tried to conciliate opposing elements by placing determined agents of each in his official family would find that he had simply strengthened discord and had deepened party divisions. While it was possible that his team of rivals would devour one another, Lincoln determined that he must risk the dangers of faction to overcome the dangers of rebellion. Later, Joseph Medill of the Chicago Tribune asked Lincoln why he had chosen a cabinet comprised of enemies and opponents. He particularly questioned the president's selection of the three men who had been his chief rivals for the Republican nomination, each of whom was still smarting from the loss. Lincoln's answer was simple, straightforward, and shrewd. We needed the strongest men of the party in the cabinet. We needed to hold our own people together. I had looked the party over and concluded that these were the very strongest men. Then I had no right to deprive the country of their services. Seward, Chase, Bates. They were indeed strong men. But in the end, it was the prairie lawyer from Springfield who would emerge as the strongest of them all. Part 2. Master Among Men. Chapter 12. Mystic Chords of Memory. On the night before her husband's March 4th inauguration, Mary Lincoln was unable to sleep. She stood by her window in the Willard Hotel and watched strangers swarming in the darkened streets below. Though all the major hotels had laid out mattresses and cots in every conceivable open space, filling parlors, reception rooms, and lobbies, thousands were still left to wander the streets and wait for the great day to dawn. Lincoln rose before sunrise to look over the inaugural address he had been crafting in his peculiar fashion. According to Nicolay, Lincoln often resorted to the process of cumulative thought. He would reduce complex ideas to paragraphs and sentences, and then, days or weeks later, return to the same passage and polish it further. to elaborate or to conclude his point or argument. While Seward or Chase would consult countless books, drawing from ancient to modern history to illustrate and refine their arguments, Lincoln built the armature of his inaugural out of four documents: the Constitution, Andrew Jackson's Nullification Proclamation, Daniel Webster's memorable Liberty and Union Forever speech, and Clay's address to the Senate arguing for the Compromise of 1850. Lincoln faced a dual challenge in this long-awaited speech, his first significant public address since his election. It was imperative that he convey his staunch resolution to defend the Union and to carry out his responsibilities as president, while at the same time mitigating the anxieties of the southern states. Finding the balance between force and conciliation was not easy, and his early draft tilted more toward the forceful side. Among the first people to see the draft was Orville Browning. Browning had intended to accompany Lincoln on the train from Springfield to Washington, but finding such a crowd of hangers-on gathering about him, he decided to end the journey in Indianapolis. Before Browning left, Lincoln handed him a copy of his draft. Browning focused on one imprudent passage that he feared would be seen in the South as a direct threat or menace, and would prove irritating even in the border states. Lincoln had pledged, "All the power at my disposal will be used to reclaim the public property and places which have fallen, to hold, occupy, and possess these and all other property and places belonging to the government." Browning suggested he delete the promise to reclaim what had already fallen, such as Fort Moultrie or Castle Pinckney, limiting himself to hold, occupy, and possess what was still in Union hands. "In any conflict which may ensue between the government and the seceding states," Browning argued, "it is very important that the traitors shall be the aggressors, and that they be kept constantly and palpably in the wrong." Though in a number of private conversations during the long secession winter, Lincoln had expressed his determination to take back the fallen properties, he accepted Browning's argument and took out the promise to reclaim places that the seceding states had already taken. Of all who read the draft, it was Seward who had the largest impact on Lincoln's inaugural address. Seward had read the initial draft with a heavy heart. Though he believed Lincoln's argument for the perpetuity of the Union was strong and conclusive, he felt that the bellicose tone of the text would render useless all the hard work, all the risks taken during the previous weeks to stop the secession movement from expanding. Working on the draft for hours, seated in his favorite swivel chair, Seward wrote a long, thoughtful letter to Lincoln that contained scores of revisions. Taken together, his suggested changes softened the tone of the draft, made it more conciliatory toward the South. Lincoln's text had opened on a forceful note, pledging himself, bound by duty, upon the plainest grounds of good faith, to abide by the Chicago platform, without liberty to shift his position. Since many seceders considered the Chicago platform one of the touchstones of their withdrawal from the Union, this was clearly a provocative beginning. Even Bates had lambasted the Chicago platform as exclusive and defiant, needlessly exposing the party to the specious charge of favoring Negro equality. Seward argued that unless Lincoln eliminated his words pledging strict adherence to the platform, he would give such advantages to the disunionists that Virginia and Maryland will secede, and we shall within 90, perhaps within 60 days, be obliged to fight the South for this capital. In that case, the dismemberment of the Republic would date from the inauguration of a Republican administration. Lincoln agreed to delete the reference to the Chicago platform entirely. Seward also criticized Lincoln's pledge to reclaim fallen properties and to hold those still belonging to the government. He suggested that the text refer more ambiguously to the exercise of power. Lincoln had already planned to change the text as Browning advised, so he ignored this overly compromising suggestion and retained his pledge to hold, occupy, and possess the properties still belonging to the federal government, including Fort Sumter. Seward's revisions are evident in nearly every paragraph. He qualified some, removed rough edges in others. Where Lincoln had referred to the secession ordinances and the acts of violence as treasonable, Seward substituted the less accusatory revolutionary. With the Dred Scott decision in mind, Lincoln warned against turning the government over to the despotism of the few men, life officers, composing the court. Seward deleted the word despotism and elevated the court to read that eminent tribunal. Lincoln had decried the idea of an amendment to the Constitution to ensure that Congress could never interfere with slavery in the states where it already existed. "I am rather for the old ship," he had written, "and the chart of the old pilots." Lincoln's stance put Seward in a difficult position. At Lincoln's behest, he had introduced the controversial resolution that called for the amendment in the first place. Lincoln's reversal now would leave Seward exposed. Treading carefully, Seward suggested that Lincoln acknowledge a diversity of opinion surrounding the proposed amendment, and that his own views would only aggravate the dispute. As it happened, Lincoln went further than Seward had suggested. In the early hours of the night before the inauguration, Congress, in its final session, had passed the proposed amendment to the effect that the federal government shall never interfere with the domestic institutions of the states. In light of this action, Lincoln reversed his position yet again. He revised his passage to say that since Congress had proposed the amendment, and since he believed such a provision to now be implied constitutional law, I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable. Seward's greatest contribution to the tone and substance of the inaugural address was in its conclusion. Lincoln's finale threw down the gauntlet to the South. "With you, and not with me, is the solemn question of shall it be peace or a sword?" Seward recommended a very different closing, designed to meet and remove prejudice and passion in the South, and despondency and fear in the East. Some words of affection, some of calm and cheerful confidence. He suggested two alternate endings. Lincoln drew upon Seward's language to create his immortal coda. Seward suggested, "I close. We are not, we must not be, aliens or enemies, but fellow countrymen and brethren. Although passion has strained our bonds of affection too hardly, they must not, I am sure they will not, be broken. The mystic cords which, proceeding from so many battlefields and so many patriot graves, pass through all the hearts and all the hearths in this broad continent of ours, will yet again harmonize in their ancient music when breathed upon by the guardian angel of the nation." Lincoln proceeded to recast and sharpen Seward's patriotic sentiments into a concise and powerful poetry. "I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave, to every living heart and hearthstone, all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union, when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." Most significant, Seward's guardian angel breathes down on the nation from above. Lincoln's better angels are inherent in our nature as a people. After placing his finishing touches on the final draft, Lincoln read the speech to his family. Then he asked to be left alone. Several blocks away, Seward had finished reading the morning newspapers and was getting ready to go to the Capitol, when a chorus of voices outside attracted his attention. Hundreds of devoted followers were assembled in front of his house. Moved by the spirit of the serenade, Seward spoke to them with emotion. "I have been a representative of my native state in the Senate for 12 years, and there is no living being who can look in my face and say that in all that time I have not done my duty toward all, the high and the low, the rich and the poor, the bond and the free." Perhaps this show of popular support softened the wrenching realization that his chance had come and gone. When a congressman argued with him that a certain politician would be disappointed if he didn't get an appointment in the new administration, Seward lost his composure. "Disappointment? You speak to me of disappointment? To me, who was justly entitled to the Republican nomination for the presidency, and who had to stand aside and see it given to a little Illinois lawyer?" As the clock struck noon, President Buchanan arrived at the Willard to escort the president-elect to the ceremony. Lincoln, only 52, tall and energetic in his shiny new black suit and stovepipe hat, presented a striking contrast to the short and thick-set Buchanan, nearly 70, who had a sorrowful expression on his aged face. As they moved arm in arm toward the open carriage, the Marine Band played "Hail to the Chief." The carriage made its way up Pennsylvania Avenue, while cheering crowds and hundreds of dignitaries mingled uneasily with the hundreds of troops put in place by General Scott to guard against an attempted assassination. Sharpshooters looked down from windows and rooftops. Cavalry were placed strategically throughout the entire route. Along the way, an ominous sound was heard. A sharp, cracking, rasping sort of detonation, at regular intervals of perhaps 3 seconds, set everyone's nerves on edge, the Washington Evening Star reported. The perplexed police finally identified the sound as issuing from the New England delegation. They wore their customary pegged shoes, with heavy soles designed for the ice and snow of the North Country. In the more temperate climate of Washington, the heat and dryness of the atmosphere had apparently shrunk the peg timber in the footgear excessively, occasioning a general squeaking with every movement, swelling in the aggregate, when the delegation marched in step. As the day brightened, Washington, according to one foreign observer, assumed an almost idyllic garb. Though the city displayed an unfinished aspect, with the monument to President Washington still only one-third of its intended height, the new Capitol Dome 2 years away from completion, and most of the streets unpaved, the numerous trees and gardens were very pleasing, creating the feel of a large rural village. The appearance of Lincoln on the square platform constructed out from the east portico of the Capitol was met with loud cheers from more than 30,000 spectators. Mary sat behind her husband, their 3 sons beside her. In the front row, along with Lincoln, sat President Buchanan, Senator Douglas, and Chief Justice Taney, 3 of the 4 men Lincoln had portrayed in his House Divided speech as conspiring carpenters intent on destroying the original house the framers had designed and built. Lincoln's old friend Edward Baker, who had moved to Oregon and won a seat in the Senate, introduced the president-elect. Lincoln made his way to the little table from which he was meant to speak. Noting Lincoln's uncertainty as to where to place his stovepipe hat, Senator Douglas reached over, took the hat, and placed it on his own lap. Then Lincoln began. his clear, high voice, trained in the outdoor venues of the Western states, could be heard from the far reaches of the crowd. Having dropped his opening pledge of strict fealty to the Chicago platform, Lincoln moved immediately to calm the anxieties of the Southern people, quoting an earlier speech in which he had promised that he had no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so. He turned then to the controversial fugitive slave law, repeating his tenet that while safeguards should be put in place to ensure that free men were not illegally seized, the U.S. Constitution required that the slaves shall be delivered upon claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. Although he understood that the fugitive slave law offended the moral sense of many people in the North, he felt compelled, under the Constitution, to enforce it. Lincoln went on to make his powerful case for continued federal authority over what he insisted, in view of the Constitution and the laws, was an unbroken union. While there needs to be no bloodshed, he intended to execute the laws, to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties and imposts. But beyond what may be necessary for these objects, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere. Physically speaking, we cannot separate, Lincoln declared, prophetically adding, suppose you go to war, you cannot fight always, and when, after much loss on both sides, and no gain on either, you cease fighting, the identical old questions as to terms of intercourse are again upon you. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. He closed with the lyrical assurance that the mystic chords of memory will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely as they will be, by the better angels of our nature. At the end of the address, Chief Justice Taney walked slowly to the table. The Bible was opened, and Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as the 16th President of the United States. The mansion was in a perfect state of readiness when the Lincolns arrived, Mary's cousin Elizabeth Grimsley observed. A competent chef, with efficient butler and waiters, under the direction of the accomplished Miss Harriet Lane, had an elegant dinner prepared. As Buchanan bade farewell, he said to Lincoln, "If you are as happy, my dear sir, on entering the house, as I am in leaving it and returning home, you are the happiest man in this country." After some hasty unpacking, the Lincolns dressed for the inaugural ball, held in the rear of the City Hall, in a room referred to as the Muslim Palace of Aladdin, because of the abundance of white draperies trimmed with blue used in its decoration. Brightened by 5 enormous chandeliers, the room accommodated 2,000 people, though the hooped crinolines worn by the women took up a good deal of space. Seward was there with his daughter-in-law, Anna. Chase was accompanied by the lovely Kate. Still, this night, Mary shone as the brightest star. Dressed all in blue, with a necklace and bracelets of gold and pearls, she danced the quadrille with her old beau, Stephen Douglas, and remained at the ball for several hours after the departure of her exhausted husband. While the party was still in full swing, word of Lincoln's inaugural speech was making its way across the country, carried by telegraph and printed in dozens of evening newspapers. In Auburn, Francis and Fanny waited in suspense throughout the night for the paper to arrive. Finally, Fanny heard a sound downstairs and raced to find out the news. "What an inappreciable relief," Fanny wrote in her diary when she read that the ceremony went off without violence. "For months I have felt constant anxiety for Father's safety, and of course joined in the fears so often expressed that Lincoln would never see the 5th of March." The news traveled more slowly west of St. Joseph, Missouri, where the telegraph lines stopped. Dozens of Pony Express riders, traveling in relays, carried the text of the address to the Pacific coast. They did their job well. In a record time of 7 days and 17 hours, Lincoln's words could be read in Sacramento, California. Reactions to his speech varied widely, depending on the political persuasion of the commentators. Republican papers lauded the address as grand and admirable in every respect, and convincing in argument, concise and pithy in manner. It was eminently conciliatory, the Philadelphia Bulletin observed, extolling the president's determination to secure the rights of the whole country, of every state under the Constitution. The Commercial Advertiser of New York claimed that the inaugural was the work of Mr. Lincoln's own pen and hand, unaltered by any to whom he confided its contents. In Northern Democratic papers, the tone was less charitable. "A wretchedly botched and unstatesmanlike paper," the Hartford Times opined. "It is he that is the nullifier," the Albany Atlas and Argus raged. "It is he that defies the will of the majority. It is he that initiates civil war." Not surprisingly, negative reactions were stronger in the South. The Richmond Enquirer argued that the address was couched in the cool, unimpassioned, deliberate language of the fanatic, pursuing the promptings of fanaticism, even to the dismemberment of the government with the horrors of civil war. In ominous language, the Wilmington, North Carolina Herald warned that the citizens of America might as well open their eyes to the solemn fact that war is inevitable. But beneath the blustery commentary in the majority of Southern papers, the historian Benjamin Thomas notes, the address won some favorable comment in the all-important loyal slave states of Virginia and North Carolina. This was the audience Seward had targeted when he told Lincoln to soften the tone of his speech. Indeed, Seward was greatly relieved, not only because he realized many of his suggestions had been adopted, but because Lincoln's conciliatory stance had given him cover with his critics in Congress. He could now leave the Senate, he told his wife, without getting any bones broken, content with having provided a foundation on which an administration can stand. Likewise, Charles Francis Adams, Sr., felt that a great burden had been lifted from his shoulders when Lincoln accepted the controversial amendment that prevented Congress from ever interfering with slavery. Having sponsored the amendment in the House, to the great dismay of the hardliners, Adams now felt that he had been fully justified in the face of the country by the head of the nation as well as of the Republican Party. "Thus ends this most trying period of our history. I should be fortunate if I closed my political career now. I have gained all that I can for myself, and I shall never have such another opportunity to benefit my country." Of the reactions to the inaugural speech, perhaps the most portentous came from within the Republican Party itself. Radicals and abolitionists were disheartened by what they considered an appeasing tone. The news of Lincoln's election had initially provided some desperately needed hope to the black abolitionist Frederick Douglass. The dramatic life of the former slave, who became an eloquent orator and writer, was well known in the North. He had been owned by several cruel slaveholders, but his second master's kindly wife had taught him to read. When the master found out, he stopped the instruction immediately, warning his wife that it was unlawful as well as unsafe to teach a slave to read. There would be no keeping him. It would forever unfit him to be a slave. It would make him discontented and unhappy. These words proved prescient. Young Douglas soon felt that learning to read had been a curse rather than a blessing. It had given me a view of my wretched condition without the remedy. He fervently wished that he were dead, or perhaps an animal. Anything, no matter what, to get rid of thinking. Only the faraway hope of escaping to freedom kept him alive. While waiting 6 years for his chance, he surreptitiously learned to write. At the age of 20, Douglas managed to escape from Maryland to New York, eventually becoming a lecturer with the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, headed by William Lloyd Garrison. His autobiography made him a celebrity in anti-slavery circles, allowing him to edit his own monthly paper in Rochester, New York. Throughout all his writings, the historian David Blight argues, there was no more pervasive theme in Douglas' thought than the simple sustenance of hope in a better future for blacks in America. Douglas believed that the election of a Republican president foretold a rupture in the power of the slaveocracy. It has taught the North its strength and shown the South its weakness. More important still, it has demonstrated the possibility of electing, if not an abolitionist, at least an anti-slavery reputation to the presidency. But when Douglas read the inaugural, beginning with Lincoln's declaration that he had no lawful power to interfere with slavery in the states, and worse still, no inclination to do so, he found little reason for optimism. More insufferable was Lincoln's readiness to catch fugitive slaves, to shoot them down if they rise against their oppressors, and to prohibit the federal government irrevocably from interfering for their deliverance. The whole tone of the speech, Douglas claimed, revealed Lincoln's compulsion to grovel before the foul and withering curse of slavery. Some thought we had in Mr. Lincoln the nerve and decision of an Oliver Cromwell, but the result shows that we merely have a continuation of the Pierces and Buchanans. The White House family quarters were then confined to the west end of the second floor. Lincoln chose a small bedroom with a large dressing room on the southwest side. Mary took the more spacious room adjacent to her husband's, while Willie and Tad occupied a bedroom across the hall. Beyond the ample sleeping quarters, there was only one other private space, an oval room filled with bookcases that Mary turned into the family's library. At the east end of the same floor was a sleeping chamber shared by Nicolay and Hay, and a small, narrow workspace that opened onto the president's simply furnished office. The rest of the mansion was largely open to the public. In the first few weeks, Seward reported to his wife, the grounds, halls, stairways, closets were overrun with hundreds of people, standing in long, winding lines and waving their letters of introduction in desperate hope of securing a job. For Willie and Tad, now 10 and almost 8, respectively, the early days in the White House were filled with great adventures. They ran from floor to floor, inspecting every room. They talked with everyone along the way. From Edward, the doorkeeper, Stackpole, the messenger, to the maids and scullions. Willie was a noble, beautiful boy, Elizabeth Grimsley observed, of great mental activity, unusual intelligence, wonderful memory, methodical, frank, and loving, a counterpart of his father, save that he was handsome. Willie spent hours memorizing railroad timetables and would entertain his friends by conducting an imaginary train from Chicago to New York with perfect precision and dramatic flair. He was an avid reader, a budding writer, and generally sweet-tempered, all reminiscent of his father. Tad, to whom Willie was devoted, bore greater resemblance to his mother. Healthy and high-spirited, he had a blazing temper, which disappeared as quickly as it came. He was a merry, spontaneous fellow, bubbling over with innocent fun, whose laugh rang through the house when not moved to tears. Irrepressible and undisciplined, never hesitant to interrupt his father in the midst of a cabinet meeting, he was the life, as also the worry, of the household. A speech impediment made it hard for anyone outside his family to understand his words, but he never stopped talking. He had, John Hay recalled, a very bad opinion of books and no opinion of discipline. The boys harried the staff at the executive mansion, racing through the hallways, playing advocate for the most anguished office seekers, organizing little plays in the garret, and setting off all the servants' bells at the same time. Fearing that her boys would grow lonely and isolated, Mary found them two lively companions in 12-year-old Horatio Nelson, Bud Taft, and his 8-year-old brother, Halsey, nicknamed Holly. Together with their older sister, Julia, who later wrote a small book recording their adventures in the White House, the Taft children quickly formed a tight circle with Willie and Tad. If there was any motto or slogan of the White House during the early years, Julia recalled, it was this: let the children have a good time. Mary, too, seemed happy at first, surrounded by friends and relatives, who stayed on for weeks after the inauguration. Her confidence that she could handle the demands of First Lady was buoyed by the great success of the first evening levee on the Friday after they moved in. Seward had proposed that he would lead off the social season from his own mansion, but Mary immediately took exception. Like her husband, Mary had no desire to let Seward take the first trick. She insisted that the new administration's first official entertainment take place at the White House. Though she had little time to prepare, she arranged an unforgettable event. For over 2 hours, Nicolay wrote his fiancée, Therina, the crowd poured in as rapidly as the door would admit them, and many climbed in at the windows. The President and First Lady shook hands with as many of the 5,000 well-dressed and well-behaved guests as they could. Even the blue-blood Charles Francis Adams was impressed by Mary's poise, though he found Lincoln to be wholly ignorant of formal social courtesy. Nonetheless, according to Nicolay, the levee was voted by all the oldest inhabitants to have been the most successful one ever known here. Mary was thrilled. "This is certainly a very charming spot," she wrote her friend Hannah Shearer several weeks later, "and I have formed many delightful acquaintances. Every evening our blue room is filled with the elite of the land. Last eve we had about 40 to call in to see us ladies, from Vice P. Breckenridge down. I am beginning to feel so perfectly at home and enjoy everything so much. The conservatory attached to this house is so delightful." Scarcely concealing her pride at having outdone her older sister Elizabeth, she told Hannah that Elizabeth had so enjoyed herself at the festivities that she cannot settle down at home since she has been here. A light and capricious sleeper, Lincoln generally awakened early in the morning. Before breakfast, he liked to exercise, often by walking around the spacious White House grounds. After a simple meal, usually a single egg and a cup of coffee, he made his way down the corridor to his office, where on cool days a fire blazed in the white marble fireplace with a big brass fender. His work table stood between two tall windows that faced the south lawn, affording a panorama of the incomplete Washington Monument, the red-roofed Smithsonian, and the Potomac River. An armchair nearby allowed him to read in comfort, his long legs stretched before him or crossed one over the other. In the center of the chamber, which doubled as the cabinet room, stood a long oak table around which the members arranged themselves in order of precedence. Old maps hung on the wall, and over the mantel a portrait of President Andrew Jackson. A few sofas and an assortment of chairs completed the furnishings. the musty smell of tobacco, lodged in the draperies from the heavy cigar smoke of the previous president and the new Secretary of State, conveyed the atmosphere of the traditional men's club. When Lincoln entered his office on the first morning after his inauguration, he was confronted with profoundly disturbing news. On his desk, the very first thing placed in his hands was a letter from Major Anderson at Fort Sumter. The communication estimated, Lincoln later recalled, that their provisions would be exhausted before an expedition could be sent to their relief. The letter carried General Winfield Scott's endorsement, "I now see no alternative but a surrender." The immediacy of this crisis posed great difficulties for Lincoln. His revised inaugural had no longer contained a promise to reclaim fallen properties, but Lincoln had most definitely pledged to hold, occupy, and possess all properties still in federal hands. No symbol of federal authority was more important than Fort Sumter. Ever since Major Anderson, in the dead of night on December 26th, had surreptitiously moved his troops from Fort Moultrie to the better-protected Sumter, he had become a romantic hero in the North. Surrender of his garrison would be humiliating. Still, the president felt bound by his vow to his dissatisfied fellow countrymen that the new government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. The president needed time to think, but scarcely had a moment to eat or sleep amid the crush of office seekers. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, pressed in as soon as the doors were opened, ignoring the barriers set up to keep them in line. As Lincoln moved throughout the house to take his lunch, which was generally limited to bread, fruit, and milk, he had literally to run the gantlet through the crowds. Each aspirant had a story to tell, a reason why a clerkship in Washington or a job in their local post office or customs house would allow their family to survive. Time and again, Lincoln was faulted for wasting his energies. "You will wear yourself out," Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts warned. "They don't want much," Lincoln replied. "They get but little, and I must see them." Such open-heartedness indicated incompetence to many, or, worse, a sign of terrible weakness. "He has no conception of his situation," Sumner told Adams. "He is ignorant and must have help," Adams agreed, citing Seward as "our only security now." The New York Times reproved Lincoln repeatedly, writing disdainfully that he owes a higher duty to the country than to fritter away the priceless opportunities of the presidency in listening to the appeals of competing office hunters. Seward, too, was critical. "The president proposes to do all his work," he wrote home. "Of course he takes that business up first, which is pressed upon him most." Somehow, Lincoln managed, despite the chaos, to focus upon the crisis at Sumter. Late at night he would sit in the library, clothed in his long-skirted, faded dressing gown, belted around his waist, his large leather Bible beside him. He liked to read and think in his big chair by the window, observed Julia Taft, in his stocking feet, with one long leg crossed over the other, the unshod foot slowly waving back and forth, as if in time to some inaudible music. Unwilling to accept Scott's assumption that Sumter must be evacuated, Lincoln penned a note to the old general, asking for more specifics. Exactly how long could Anderson hold out? What would it take to resupply him and to reinforce Sumter? Scott's reply laid out a bleak prospect indeed.